Welcome to Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show. I'm Ted Bonnet.
I'm Phil Proctor. He's a boomer and I'm a bomber. I was born in 1940, but I guess we have some marvelous guests. Repeat guest in one instance today. And I don't think he'll be repeating himself because, number one, his life is so fascinating and so full. And number two, there's been a little time in between when we did the original show. I'm speaking of the great Leonard Maltin and his greater wife, Alice, who is with us today.
You got the brains of the outfit today.
Very good. Good. So we had such an amazing conversation at lunch that we really have nothing to talk about.
It's kind of sad.
And one of the things that, of course, we talked about privately, I've known Leonard and Alice for many years, and my darling late wife, Melinda Peterson, and I would have wonderful dinners.
We
had such fun together.
Yeah.
Anyway, one of the things we talked about was how we got out here. And it's very interesting because I have in my hands Leonard's book called Starstruck, My Unlikely Road to Hollywood. And indeed, that's kind of what all of our lives have been to get us out here. Ted's from the East Coast. I'm from Indiana and then Manhattan.
The thing is that when I was growing up and in the suburbs, Teaneck, New Jersey. 5 miles from the George Washington
Exit
Bridge.
Exit 2.
See?
That's a deep Jersey
That's
joke.
A Pacific.
Yeah.
That's the Palisades Interstate Parkway, too. It's not even a turnpike.
You want to take that route? No, 9W.
No soap radio.
I never felt a need to escape.
Yeah.
Snow and sleet would come. I would have to shovel the snow on our front walk.
Yeah.
And I hated it. And I would have to rake leaves in the fall, and I hated it.
Yeah.
But I never once said to myself, I got to get out of this place.
I come from the Bronx, from a basically Jewish ghetto in the Bronx, working class. And the reason
isn't
that
the old
Leonard,
Bronx a Jewish ghetto then? Wasn't it then? Right.
There was Riverdale
Country School.
Riverdale did not admit that they were part of the Bronx.
Alice is referring to my high school. I went to Riverdale Country School.
Yes.
And I'd known as a 5-day boarder because we had a dormitory there. So I would live there for 5 days. Then I could go, to New York for
leave,
the weekends.
Yes.
Right. And my mom was still living in our apartment on East 94th Street off of Lexington, so I could always go there.
But the South Bronx back then, Fort Apache.
I was active in Bronx politics then, and I used to stuff the information under the doors. I went into these buildings and stuff, and I was fast. I was very fast. And it was different because, yes, it was the South Bronx, but you weren't afraid. I mean, I did see somebody knifed, which was, for me, oh, my God.
I'm sorry, what did you say? I spoke over you.
Yes, so you did speak over me. I did see someone who was knifed, and I kind of, they were on the street, they were talking, and, bingo. He pulled a knife and did it.
Made a point.
Sorry. If you guys...
Phil's rubbing off on
me.
This is a serious discussion.
All right.
You're not going to... Anyway, so, I mean, we weren't afraid.
That's right.
We actually went into the buildings. Wow. We came out of the buildings, and...
It was a smoldering ruin by the 70s.
Well, it weren't good, I'll tell you that. But
so how did you connect up with Mr. Maltin over here?
Well, I was desperate, and
well, she went online. No,
we couldn't do
there
that.
There was no such time. Where is my mind? I'm sorry.
Yeah, the reason we got married quickly was because he hated the Cross Bronx Expressway, which went from the Bronx to Teaneck, New Jersey.
See?
And so that's how we got married fast. He said, I'm not going to continue to do this. I took a class at NYU Evening Extension, and I took the class because it was cheaper than Professor Richard Brown's class at the New School, which was the in place to actually go.
Yep.
And there was a Professor Herbert Graff who was teaching the class that I took. Now,
on
Herbert,
film genres.
On film genres. Genre. I didn't even know what genre meant. I mean, we didn't use that in the Bronx. We didn't say things. I loved film. My whole family, we're all film buffs. We would stay and watch the credits, and people would laugh at us because we're sitting in the theater watching the credits.
Wow. She's made for you, Leonard.
Yeah, that's about the size of it.
Match made in heaven.
Yeah. Herb said, I got her for Leonard.
And you just celebrated your 49th wedding anniversary.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank
you. To each other,
yes. a first time, and we're very lucky because...
First time and last time.
Yeah, God willing, exactly. Yeah.
So do you still both share a passion for watching movies?
Oh, gosh, yes.
We do.
Yeah?
We like holding hands.
Never gets old, huh?
No, and we like even this, you know, if you go for the Criterion Collection, mm-hmm. they have all these additional pieces of information.
The other night...
Yeah.
I just received from Criterion their new release of All That Money Can Buy, also known as The Devil and Daniel Webster,
mm.
1941 movie directed by William Dearley.
I saw it.
With Walter Huston as the devil, Mr. Scratch.
Right, Mr. Scratch, yes.
And Edward Arnold as the then politician, statesman, Daniel Webster. And my old friend Scott McQueen supervised this restoration. And it looks great. It sounds great. They fixed little glitches in the film, which you can do, you know, now digitally.
And you never notice it.
Yeah.
Mm.
And we listened to the commentary track.
Yes, we did.
By Bruce Eder and our friend Stephen Smith,
yeah.
Who wrote the definitive biography of Bernard Herrmann, whose music won him an Oscar.
Oh.
His first year in Hollywood. He had just finished scoring A Little Thing for Orson Welles, Citizen Kane. And then this was next up.
Wow.
So he won for this, but not Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
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 Isn't that something?
Yeah. And we sat there and we just reveled.
We ate it up.
Yeah.
All the additional information.
I married well.
Yes, you did. Now, do you have, what kind of a home entertainment system do you have now?
Don't ask. Nothing special.
Okay, nothing special. That's nice to know.
It's our home.
Yeah.
We have a big screen. When we were moving into this house 10 years ago, the difference between a smaller screen, a bigger screen, was actually a lot of money. And I said, Leonard, we're going to get a 75 for the bedroom because I can't mm-hmm. see a goddamn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right. It was right to do.
Yeah.
So we have an 80 downstairs.
Okay.
Which at that time was the largest that they
made. And everything is so much affordable. It's so affordable now.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, the 80 was not inexpensive, but it was.
Well, you could write all these expenses off.
That's what we did. Yes,
right.
It's a good thing.
Now you make a living, for heaven's sake.
Well, that's the advantage, you know.
You bet.
Well, you came up, you know, in New York. That was a really exciting time for film in the 70s. I mean, maybe it's because that was our coming of age time. But to me, still the 70s are the best movies ever.
Yes.
And New York.
Who disagrees with that?
Right.
And you can't find anyone who
Well, we weren't around in 1939, so we have to say the 70s. Okay.
Yeah, true. But there was a robust, edgy underground film scene in New York. It was really an exciting, you know, all the West 50s.
Yeah,
it was a really exciting place to be for film.
It was. Yeah. It was. They were always shooting somewhere. We lived at 79th and Amsterdam.
Uh-huh.
And they were shooting the one with Treat Williams, honey? The cop one?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they were doing it right on our street.
Mm-hmm.
And in the restaurant.
Sidney Lumet.
They
shot the house on 92nd Street on 94th Street.
There you go.
See?
There you go.
Stunning.
See what you
Inside stories, folks.
A day without knowledge.
Behind every great man is a great woman, right? Or
yeah.
This sounds like a real-life application of that story.
It's true. I'd be sitting here gurgling, babbling, spittle coming down the side of my cheeks without Alice.
We just have a good time. Well, we enjoy it.
It's clear, but I mean, in terms of your career, you guys went to film school together.
Well, I just took this class, and it was amazing. I didn't know you could study film. I had no idea.
I'm sorry, is that how you met?
Well, the way we met was through Professor Herbert Graff.
I was a guest lecturer in his class.
Oh.
Professor Herbert Graff, during the daytime, was a schmata salesman on 7th Avenue. He sold girl and boy
Lucky
shirts.
Girl and Lucky
girl
boy shirts.
Shirts. And that's what he did. But he knew everything about film, everything. And he's the one, I said, gee, I love film, but I don't have money. I'm just, you know, a working kid. And he said, all right, I'll take you where you can see, you know, different films. And he did take me to the Theodore Huff Society, which is...
which is William K. Everson's Secret Handshake Film Society.
What's that?
Well, William K. Everson, some of your listeners may know that name. He wrote a number of books about film. He was a film... scholar, instructor, lecturer,
aficionado,
collector, ambassador,
booster,
all-round, a mentor.
Mm-hmm. That's good, yeah.
And just the most generous man. The phrase generous to a fault describes Bill. And
you could knock on his door at 2 in the morning and say...
it's not apocryphal.
I'm doing a book on Westerns, and I think you have the so-and-so film. And, you know...
he'd invite him in.
Say, come on in.
I'll thread it up for you.
These were big cans of 16-millimeter.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And which now reside in Rochester, New York at the George Eastman Museum.
Uh-huh.
But they were... they're the property of NYU, where he taught for many years.
I see.
NYU doesn't have a film archive of its own, so they're housed upstate New York. But Bill was just one of a kind.
British. Did not really understand what he was saying.
Very low-key.
It's a wonderful essay.
You remember the...
Here's the funny part.
A friend of mine swears this is true. In a class at NYU that he was teaching, the fluorescent lights kept blinking, kind of annoyingly.
Yeah.
And he finally said to Bill, Professor, what's happening with the lights? And Bill said, oh, they're electrocuting the dean.
But that was
interesting. And another student spoke up. I can't resist. I'm sorry. Really? Another student spoke up and said, you know, Professor Everson, you're showing all these old Hollywood movies, and they always have a happy ending. I mean, you know, how is that reality? How does that reflect, you know, the lives that we all live? Always a happy ending. Bill said, have you seen King of Kings?
Bill was, he was one of a kind.
That was it. You know, in the 70s, I don't know what it is like today, but the most compelling film classes were the continuing ed classes because they were the professionals who worked all day would come in and teach at night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they would bring in all their colleagues and you just have
these
amazing...
That's what they did. That's where... And I tried to pick up Leonard, okay?
Yeah.
And he was kind of distant. He was kind of cold. I said, well, either he's got a girlfriend or he's gay. It's as simple as that. Yeah. It's one or the other. I was cute. There was no reason for him not to be receptive,
right.
Okay?
You're still cute.
Thank you. So,
And I was dumb.
Dumb. He was dumb, yeah.
Sure. I can identify with that.
It worked out.
It did. Yeah, so we watched two silent films because Bill took me to the theater. Herb took me to the Theodore Huff Society.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to go home. He didn't feel well, and he asked Leonard to look out for me. And we watched two silent films.
You sure did.
You know, the thing about it, which my friend always said, because I was older. I was already 30. Now, in New York City, if you're 30 and have no prospects, this is back in 1974, you just go to the George Washington Bridge and you jump in. Okay? Because let's face
it. Set in line.
You're going to be
a
spinster. You know, why wait? Go now. You know, not have to wait. And friends said to me, you know, you're not going to meet anybody in this class. I said, I don't care. I love it. Mm-hmm. It opened my eyes to so many things. Mm-hmm.
And you met him.
And then I met him. Magic. And we just meshed. We really did. Oh. It was, and my friend always said, when you meet the right person, you'll know. And of course you say, how do I know? She
You'll know.
And by golly, I did know.
And also when you decide to give up.
So yes.
You know,
yes.
I'm done.
No, that's it. I'm not going to just get married for the sake of getting married.
Right.
You know, as when you grow up, you know, Jewish in the Bronx, It's a written law. By 25, you have to be married, have like maybe a kid already, and be a teacher.
Right.
Okay? That kind of thing.
That's
life. It wasn't going to happen.
Well, at least he didn't take you, because the cheap films back in the 70s, usually Italian movies that weren't going to get any wide-scale distribution, the only place you could see them was on 42nd Street.
Yeah.
I never went to the movies with Alice on 42nd Street. No. I had a college pal who who became a very successful producer, in fact.
Yeah.
He and I would venture into those
forbidden zones.
Forbidden zones is right.
And believe me, it was
gruesome. Yeah. I was almost killed in one.
Yeah, it was like a movie theater takeover, wasn't it?
It was surreal.
Universal Pictures in the 70s was primarily, as a company, was MCA Universal then.
Yes.
They were really a TV factory.
Mm-hmm.
They turned out tons and tons of film television episodes.
Dual.
Very few movies. But the movies they were making, like Don Siegel was their primo director.
Yep.
And with Clint Eastwood waiting in the wings, watching and observing, working for Don Siegel, about to step up to bat and direct films himself. Well, Universal didn't open them in Manhattan.
Hmm.
And I don't know how they played off the rest of the country, but the only place you could see them was on 42nd Street.
Yeah.
And I was...
You walked very close to the gutter.
They weren't all pornographic at all.
No.
It's just that the neighborhood was.
It was there'd be early exploitation, violent exploitation films that wouldn't get wide release.
My favorite story about that is that somebody was watching one of these exploitation films on 42nd Street, and he hears from the balcony, "You're sorry? You piss on my wife and you're sorry?" That just about says it all.
That says it all.
That is all you
need to know.
Yeah, yeah.
You need to know.
And then I went back to New York once, and Giuliani had taken over, and the place had been completely sanitized.
Yeah,
it was all boarded up and empty, but it was all had fake facades. And, you never think you'd miss the bad old days. Like, you can walk down 42nd Street, or at least you could.
Oh, you can now. Yeah. I mean, it's very
everybody complains that it's bad, but we went back, and I didn't feel that at all. So, movies today, now.
Movies today?
Now. When we talked, Leonard, 3 years ago when you were on the show, we were still in the pandemic, and we were talking about literally against the law to go to see a movie at a theater, and how are we going to survive? I know with Barbieheimer, things have come back to some degree.
Remember, we also had Carl Laemmle's son, was it? On the show, and believe me, we had quite a deep conversation, a scary conversation
about him
staying afloat, you know.
But interestingly, like, so much has changed. They're now saying peak TV has passed us by.
Yeah.
The podcast business, there was a lot of enthusiastic early money they threw against the wall, and that's going through a shakeout. It's almost as if the playing field has leveled a little bit, and maybe that's giving movies and theatrical distribution more breathing room, even in the age of small personalized screens. How do you see the movie industry, the whole entertainment scene now?
Well, it's in flux.
Mm-hmm. It's a little fluxed up.
Very much fluxed up.
A Yale man? A Yale man?
No one has a crystal ball that's accurate, or else we could get rich really quick. Running a movie theater, you can't run a single screen movie theater.
No.
It's just not feasible to put all your bets on that one movie to bring in an audience for the length of time you have to play it.
A run, yeah.
So the multiplex is the only answer to that. Even if it's only two screens, you've at least doubled your odds.
Yeah, one for each eye, as Bergman used to say, right?
But you have to pay someone to clean the restrooms 52 weeks a year. Pick up the popcorn off the floor, or else people won't come back to your theater.
Yeah.
And someone's got to sell a ticket. You can purchase it online.
But you still have to check in.
Someone has to sort of monitor the comings and goings of the customers. I don't know how it's going to work.
Listen, we've gone to a couple of big theaters, Ted and I, with some friends, to see big movies. And we've been the only people in the theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they're asking us to pick our seats.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, that
I went to see Dune 2 last week in Westwood at one of the big theaters because I want to see the big movies in the big theaters to hear the state-of-the-art projection
sound.
And sound, right? And we were one of three people in the whole show, and that's a big... Now, yesterday,
matinee.
I'm in a little theater at Lemley Monica scene in the Zone of Interest, and there were like 10, 15, 12 people there.
Yeah.
So that was a pleasant
surprise. But most of them were dead. That's what you didn't notice.
But it was I think that we've gotten out of the habit.
Yes.
I know Leonard and I.
The adventure of going to movies.
Yeah, we've gotten lazy. Like, we're going to go to a screening tonight of Ghostbusters.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going, why do I have to go? Why do I have to leave the house and drive to the Grove and see? You really get out of the habit,
you
and
sure
that's
do.
Part of it.
Especially when you have home consumption options.
It's an invitation to stay home.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, the state of communications right now.
Well, it is.
And the quality level.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I went to see Zone of Interest yesterday because I wanted to see the Oscar-winning sound mix.
Right.
It's a German film.
And it's very, very subtle. It's almost like a Peter Weir film. It's just very low-key. And there were three women to the left of me, like two seats over. And right in those beautiful, quiet mixes, she, you know.
Oh, no.
Opens up. I don't know what the hell she's eating, but something crunchy with really loud cellophane.
Oh.
It's tough.
Well,
it's
there's
tough.
That. But then again, if you're at home, you know, somebody flushes the toilet. So what are you going
to
do?
You know? I don't allow anybody to flush toilets.
The problem that I have
that
with watching things.
For you.
Okay. I have macular degeneration. And Alice has revealed to me that she also has it. So those of us senior citizens who have challenged eyesight, I have found that if I watch a movie on my laptop, I can see it more clearly than I can when it's projected.
Of course.
Yeah.
Which is a good option, you know.
And if you have any hearing loss.
What?
You can put on the closed captioning.
That's right. I do all the time.
Which
we can't read because we have macular degeneration.
There's a really interesting piece in CBS Sunday Morning, Pogue. Did a piece about how closed captions are such a big thing.
Yes.
And the reasons for them are not what you would necessarily initially think. It's the mixing challenges.
Yeah, and the recording challenges too. I've talked to sound men and some filmmakers about this. In the early days of talkies, and this has been exaggerated for comic effect,
okay.
But the truth is the sound man was king. And if the sound man said that take is no good, the director had to abide by that, and they had to redo it. You see this parodied in Singing in the Rain. But those stories that Betty Comden and Adolph Green acquired to give them background for the script of Singing in the Rain, they're all based on real experiences that people had in 1929, 1930. I was friendly with the guy who was the top sound man for Columbia Pictures, who recorded all of Frank Capra's movies and all the other major films and minor films, too. If he wasn't working on a Frank Capra A picture at Columbia, he was working on a Buck Jones Saturday matinee Western. Cowboy film. Anyway, he said that the clarity of recording, and this is before lavaliers. This is all coming from one overhead boom mic.
Yep. As opposed to a lavalier, which is a clip microphone right in front of you on your shirt.
Or hidden underneath costume.
It had to be intelligible.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be intelligible. And I don't think very many filmmakers today place a value on that.
Boy, is that true.
Enough.
But also you have to think, you know, it's not too long ago that movies were all in mono. And they're all a solitary speaker behind the screen. So it was all center mix. So it was dialogue centric.
Yeah.
Now you have these 7-1-4 systems, which you have speakers all around you. And that's opening this immersive world of which dialogue is only a small part of it.
Right.
And some like directors like Christopher Nolan, who's known for...
He thinks it's okay if you can't understand.
He thinks that dialogue is a stylistic effect.
Yeah.
And it's true. And
I heartily disagree. I have great respect for Mr. Nolan. I've met Mr. Nolan. He even came to my class at USC with his first film, Following, which is a very clever little film that was made on weekends over a year's time. It's worth seeing. It's in black and white. It's his least pretentious and best movie, in my not humble opinion. The idea that he wants to deliberately obscure the dialogue in some of his films just drives me batty.
You're listening to Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show. Our guest today is film movie maestro Leonard Maltin and his half-side, Alice.
What drives me crazy, again, as a senior citizen who is also losing his hearing, when I'm sitting in a theater and I'm sitting and watching a scene between people who are whispering, what the heck? Why don't they speak up, for God's sake? You know, and you don't get captions in a movie theater.
No.
So there are times when I honestly miss stuff, right?
Yet.
Oh, you don't get captioning yet.
I guess it was yesterday when I was in the theater to see Zone of Interest. I was like, huh? And I reached for my remote to go back. I can't do that.
Yeah, no, we're getting spoiled. We're getting spoiled.
I know that when we watch a film in the house, you're constantly adjusting the sound.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but what's going on at the screen? You know, on the screen.
Yeah, if it's lower, you can.
Why should I have to?
And they have adjustments that are very, very crude, but they have level adjusters like limiters to keep everything. But you have to always have, especially if you go between platforms.
Absolutely.
Like YouTube is many decibels louder.
That's right. Absolutely.
Than, say Netflix or vice versa.
Yeah.
So what do you see these days? What do you think are some of the big films that people should see?
Well, if you haven't seen all five international Oscar nominees for the just completed Oscar awards, you're missing out. All five are exceptional. Anatomy of a Fall from France, which won two Oscars.
I haven't seen that yet.
Teacher's Lounge from Germany.
Oh, I saw that, yes.
Io Capitano.
Io Capitano. Highly recommended.
By Matteo Garrone.
And The Snow.
Society of the Snow, the Spanish film about the famous, notorious airplane crash.
In the Andes?
The cannibalism.
In South America.
Isn't that on? I think that's streaming already. I think that's
it is.
Can see.
Yeah.
Can you see most of these on the stream?
Well, see, and that's the problem, too.
Mm-hmm.
Why should I go to a theater if I wait a little bit longer?
That's right.
I can watch
But on the other hand, certain films like Oppenheimer. You know,
you want the immersive experience.
We saw that in IMAX, and I didn't see why it had to be in IMAX.
I didn't see the big deal. Really?
Oh, I did. Yeah, you know, I went through the whole process of that and ended up going to the Westwood Village to see it in 70mm on the big screen. I don't know. When you go to an IMAX film, they can be fantastic, but also I find myself looking around because I can't see the whole screen in one glimpse.
Yeah, right.
And that kind of takes
you
a little
some exercise.
Yeah, you get a little exercise, but it takes you out of it too, a little bit. So the international films this year are really good.
Yeah, superior.
Well, isn't the other one the Korean film?
Past Lives.
Past Lives? Is that one of them?
That was not an international feature.
Okay, we do not recommend that, ladies and gentlemen.
No, a lot of people love that film.
They love that film.
That's what I've heard, too.
Yeah.
And then some other people said,
we didn't, Leonard and I, we just, you know.
Again, I admire it. I respect it. Yeah. I have greatest respect for Celine Song.
Yes, the director.
A playwright who, making her first film. And she came to my class at USC, was a wonderful guest. I saw it under perfect conditions, and it just didn't speak to me.
That's always hard, you know.
Well, it's personal, too. I mean, I went to Dune 2, and I love Dune 1. Dune 2 left me cold.
Mm-hmm. I do want to mention that when I went to Yale, there was a fellow named Eisenhower who was helping us computerize our lighting system. This is 1959 to 62, and he created a computerized lighting system for us in the theater. We did Tennessee Williams' Camino Reel, and there was a section in that play where people are escaping in an airplane. And we designed it in such a way that the airplane flew overhead, over the head of the audience, confetti came down on them, and the sound, we play speakers all the way around, even to the back of the theater. And because of this Eisenhower board, as they called it, they were able to move the sound all past people overhead and into the back of the theater. So it really kind of started there, in this immersive experience.
I will never, ever forget seeing Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now at the now...
Ziegfeld.
Yeah, at the now shuttered Ziegfeld Theater. 3,000
I can't believe our parallel lives, because I think I told you when we talked the first time, I left work at WPIX in the news building to see the very first noon show at the Ziegfeld. And it was a really hot day, and I got in a cab because I was in a real hurry to get there in time. And we were held up on 42nd Street because a guy was shot dead in front of Grand Central Terminal. I saw the body.
Oh, how rude.
How rude.
New York.
But it did put me in the sensibility of that movie. And I got in there, and it was air conditioned, and all of a sudden the helicopter started flying, and I don't think I've ever been more affected, other than seeing Man Who Fell to Earth in the theater the first time, than Apocalypse Now, because that was the advent of
the other film of similar vintage that I saw at one of the East Side Manhattan movie houses, not a gigantic theater or a theater noted for anything particular about it, but I saw Woodstock there. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that these were not people in the movie theater calling out,
yes,
oohs and ahs and hey, whatever they were saying. Those utterances were part of the film's soundtrack, the sound mix. Just revolutionary.
Well, Ziegfeld was really the forefront of all of that.
Yeah.
That's where they had the subwoofer for Earthquake and Towering Inferno.
Oh, yeah. Sensorround.
Sensorround.
I remember a friend of mine, Paul Wilson. Melinda and Paul and I saw a movie at the Writers Guild that we really didn't care for. And Paul said as we walked out, well, at least it wasn't in Smell-O-Vision.
Now, when we lived in New York, one weekend, we realized that a film we were curious to see hadn't gotten a press invitation to was playing at only the Ziegfeld, and it was called Honky Tonk Highway.
Hmm. Oh, I remember.
Directed
that.
By John Schlesinger.
Yeah.
This is post Midnight Cowboy.
Wow.
And a very motley cast. And it was pretty well universally agreed upon that it was a dog.
Yeah.
It was a misfire.
Yeah.
But we said, let's go see it at the Ziegfeld. So we went to the Saturday 8 p.m. show at the Ziegfeld, and half dozen people in the whole place. That seats 3,000. Mm. And as we were leaving, I said, wait a minute. If no one shows up, is there still a 10 p.m. show?
Ah.
And we never did find out the answer.
Well, I can tell you, I worked in the movie theaters. It was my first job. And we would just, hey, no one's coming. No one's coming. And then it was like, this was a drive-in movie theater. It's like, oh, here comes a car. And if it was one car, mostly because the projectionists were union.
Yeah.
That's why. It was the projectionist.
The projectionist
back in the day, and I don't know if it's still that way, but they ruled.
Yeah. Yep.
They ruled.
When I was doing I did a play, The Cherry Orchard in New York, a lot of funny stories about that, which you can read in my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, by the way, or listen to me speaking it. And Abe Vigoda was in the cast. And we there was a snowstorm, of course, in New York in the winter in the Cherry Orchard. Okay, and he said that he was in a play once where one woman came and was going to meet her friends, and then a blizzard struck. And the rule is with equity, if the cast outnumbers the audience, you don't have to do the show. But they decided they have nowhere to go. There's a blizzard outside. They did the entire show, whatever it was, for this one nice old lady.
Okay, I like that.
Lightly.
Yes,
we're here. Let's do it. You know?
So your book you brought here, Leonard Moulton's Starstruck.
I wish you could see the cover.
Road to Hollywood.
It's a beautiful cover.
Beautiful cover. Tell us about this.
Well,
your unlikely road to Hollywood. What route did you take?
I should have taken a left at the Coachella Valley, as Bugs Bunny sometimes says.
Take Selma. Take Selma, honey.
Yeah, take Selma. Yeah. I've had a lot of interesting experiences in my life, and I didn't want to call it an autobiography or a memoir. They sounded too pretentious to me, like, who am I to write a memoir? I'm not Somerset Maugham. I'm not But I've had really interesting experiences. And I thought that I should set them down. And it was a pandemic project.
Uh-huh.
It gave me something to wake up and work on,
right,
and focus on, and relive and recycle in my brain.
It was really strange because you start to realize what your life is.
So it was really a dual memory.
He would say to me, you know, when did we actually blah, blah, blah?
Right.
Because you have to try to put it together.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and...
Were you the editor? Were you...
No. I was just a big mouth. I'm not the editor. I just...
But luckily you were there for most of this.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're a fact checker.
Sounding board.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sounding board.
And, we were extraordinarily lucky when we came out here. We came out here in 82, and people that we'd want to know, we got to know.
Yeah.
The older directors, stars. Yeah. We were very lucky.
And you came out with Entertainment Tonight, right?
I auditioned for E.T., the short version of the story. I was on the Today Show.
Right.
Promoting one of my books, The Great Movie Comedians, just before Memorial Day.
Because we were going to go up to Brimfield for the
antique. In spring of 1982, we were going to go... Yeah, that's right.
We had to stay in the city because you were doing this stupid interview.
So Gene Shalit was then the film critic and entertainment.
Big deal,
on the show a long time. So then as now, that was a great booking.
Yes.
If you're trying to sell anything, your book, promote anything. You know, someone 3,000 miles away from us here in Los Angeles, who worked for Paramount Television, called the man who had just been hired to rescue a floundering TV show called Entertainment Tonight, which was in its first season. And the man that they hired, Barry Diller, then at Paramount.
Barry Diller, big deal.
Legendary newspaper editor named Jim Bellows, who was then editing the LA Herald Examiner. And he... like the challenge of taking on a TV show, a nightly half-hour TV show, not unlike a daily newspaper. Got to get everything together and unforgiving deadline.
That's
every
right.
single
every
day.
Every day, wow.
And so this fellow called Jim Bellows and said, "You're looking for a film critic, aren't you?" And Jim said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I just saw a guy on the Today Show. I think you ought to check him out." So back in Manhattan, our phone rings. Alice picks up the phone, and the guy says, "May I speak to Leonard Maltin?" She says, "Whom may I say is calling?" He says, "Bruce Cook from Entertainment Tonight." Alice says, "May I ask what it's in reference to?" He says, "Employment." She said, "Yours or his?"
Nice.
She said, he said, "His." So in that case, I'll put him right on.
Good. What a good filter.
And they said, "Was I interested in auditioning?" Sure. I had no dream or goal of being on TV.
Really?
No, that was fine.
And we didn't want to go to the coast. A lot of people in our building were waiting for that call.
I'll be darned.
And we weren't.
You were happy in New York.
We were very happy in New York.
Yeah.
We had a good life and a great apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
West 79th Street.
First, they were going to have me do it in New York. That's right. They were going to have me do it at their satellite office in Manhattan.
Sure. They
then Bruce called back and said, "We think it'd be better if you came out here."
Oh.
And I said, "Why in particular?" He said, "Well, this way we can meet each other. You could see how things operate here." I said, "Okay." He said, "So can you come out tomorrow?"
So typical, you know. Yeah.
Typical of television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I had a terrible cold. The last thing I wanted to do was get on a plane. He said, "Well, we'll have so-and-so call you and set up the details." Well, the next day I was on a plane out of JFK to Los Angeles. And the day after that, I was taken into the offices, which were at Merv Griffin's studio and headquarters on Vine Street.
Nice, yeah.
And which had been a radio studio originally.
Yeah, and Fireside Theater wrote Zachariah there, by the way.
Oh, boy. It was the home of a popular radio show called Breakfast in Hollywood.
Yep, that's right.
And I later learned. So Jim Bellows said to me, Well, you know, we brought you out here to do movie reviews. No, I didn't know that. No one had told me anything. So could you write two reviews tomorrow morning? I said, and at that moment, I swear, my thoughts flashed back to stories I had read about the early silent days when little crowds would gather at the gates of Universal and Paramount and the other studios, and an assistant director would come out early in the morning and point to someone and say, "You, can you ride a horse?"
Yeah.
And if you wanted to make $5, you said yes.
That's right.
If you couldn't ride a horse, you might get $3 to just be an extra, crowd extra. So he said, "So can you do two reviews tomorrow morning?" I said, "You bet."
Oh, boy.
And they gave me a producer to work with who saved my life because he showed me how to prepare a review for television, not to be read, but to be heard, and to include a film clip from the movie under discussion, and then to lower the volume on the film clip and continue with voiceover narration. And that was Steve Pasquet, and God bless you, Steve. And so it happens I had just seen two movies that were about to open.
Perfect.
And so I reviewed, I think, Annie.
Yeah, we were at a film festival.
And Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Oh, wow.
Perfect.
So I did these reviews in Merv's studio audience. I was in a real theater.
Yeah.
So that was not make-believe. That was a real theater. It was a make-believe movie screen when they cut to the over my shoulder.
So this is your first really performance?
Yeah.
Ever.
Wow.
Ever. I'd done a lot of talk shows as a guest.
Yeah, that's quite
being
different.
Being interviewed about my books.
Quite different.
Entirely different. And the line producer on the show was Vin DiBona.
Oh, gosh, he's still doing great with all the animals are funny.
Yeah.
People are stupid.
His funniest home videos.
Oh, my God. Vin DiBona. I've worked with him. I've worked with him. Lovely guy.
Vin's a good guy. Anyway, Vin says to me, "You know, if it was up to me, I'd hire you on the spot. But it's not up to me. It's up to the Paramount execs.
Suits.
But I know they're really anxious to fill this role on the show, and I'm sure you'll be hearing something soon." And with that, I took a taxi. Remember taxis?
I heard of them.
I took a taxi to LAX and flew home. And that was the Thursday of Memorial Day weekend, 1982. The next day, we flew to Columbus, Ohio, for something called the Sin Event, which was a gathering that has been going on for
film buffs
for many years, for film collectors and old movie buffs and silent film buffs.
And you were going as fans.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so on Saturday, I'm in the dealer's room looking at 8x10 stills and posters.
Yeah.
And somebody says, "Hey, you were good on TV last night." I said,
What?
I said, "Doing what? Doing a movie review?" He said, yeah, that's what you're doing. Oh, my God. Well, now it's the weekend. No one to call.
Yeah.
And, in fact, it was a holiday weekend. We flew home on Monday, Memorial Day.
Yeah.
And in those days, your message machine was a reel-to-reel tape recorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A miniaturized reel-to-reel tape recorder. It was full. It was full.
Congratulations.
I heard from relatives I hadn't spoken to in ages, old friends, new friends, and one lucid friend who said, "They actually introduced you as their new film critic."
Ah.
So Tuesday morning, I called Bruce Cook, who was the associate producer of the show, and I said, "Does this mean I got the job?" He said, "No." But we had the review. It was current. We thought we ought to run it. And I'd signed an AFTRA piece of paper.
Yeah.
They were going to pay me a scale. So they didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
But it would have been nice to tell me. And then later that week, they ran the second review, again without telling me.
Oh, how bizarre.
And my wife here said, "You know what's going to happen?" I said, "What?" She said, "When the third week comes along and they don't have another review, they're going to call again." That's what happened. They called on Monday and said, "Could you come out tomorrow and tape some more reviews?" I said, "Actually, no, I can't." And Bruce said, "Why?" I said, "I haven't seen any other movies." He said, "Oh, well, could you do it by the end of the week?" I said, well, I'll make sure I do it by the end of the week.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe they were playing something nice on the plane.
Yeah, you never know.
Well, that's no good, because if the movie sucks, you can't walk out.
Yeah. Yeah, you can, but it's a long way down.
So I've always said, because I ended up staying there 30 years.
Wow.
Through eight producers.
So like a light switch. It's just everything changed. Just,
yes.
And yes. And then you came out here, and you've been here, eventually you moved out.
40 years.
You've been out here 40 years, and you, Alice, you're like the quintessential New Yorker.
Oh, yeah, I never want.
But you're happy.
It's very funny, happy. Again, we talked about this at lunch. We're having lunch at the Good Neighbor restaurant next door to the studio that we have to leave, but that's another story. And there, you had an apartment, your first apartment, right around the corner.
Yeah, no, we had.
They used to use the dry cleaner in the little mall where we're eating.
No, I was pregnant, and I ate in the Carl Jr.'s across the street.
I love
it. They had a salad bar.
I always thought coming out here was interesting. You can't compare New York to L.A. or vice versa.
No.
It's truly, for lack of a better term, apples and oranges. And it's what you make of it.
That's right.
I don't think there are two places as dissimilar as New York and L.A.
I agree.
I mean, you know, maybe Mumbai, you know, would be another.
Especially when we came out.
An apricot, not an apple or an orange, you know. But within these United States, there are no two
cities.
It's
another country. But it really was at that time.
But New York
country.
Is a great young person's game. I mean, when Phil and I went to New York in December, you know, we had a great 5 days. And then we were like, I'm done. And you come out to L.A. and it's appropriate.
To me, what always
pace.
Amazed me was you have to learn how to drive out here. You can't walk, really. And if you live in a neighborhood, maybe you can walk around, but you can't, walk. Anyway, you can't walk. So if you move the letters of Los Angeles around, it spells legs on sale. If you move the letters of New York around, it's why no work. Because you gotta have a job to live in New York, especially now.
Well, it was affordable then.
It was affordable.
You know, again, just not to harp on when I was a young man. But I am glad I had the first part of my life there.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I got my street smarts.
Yeah. That's right.
Growing
that's
up
right.
in New York. And
we wanted to live in Manhattan. Leonard's parents said, well, why don't you live in Jersey? You're just over the bridge.
I have the same
thing. You can see everything. And we said, we want to wake up in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And they thought we were
crazy. I had an apartment in Fort Lee.
Yeah, exactly.
And all I did would walk down to the waterfront and listen to the rumble and roar of New York and go, why am I only there during the day?
They would
be embarrassed that we lived in Manhattan.
Really?
Yes, their friends,
that's so
funny. The friends would say, so where do the kids live? And they'd say, well, they live in Manhattan because he's working. And an excuse for living in Manhattan.
I had schoolmates who never went to the city.
From Teaneck.
Yeah.
Which you have to understand, folks, that's like, a 15-minute drive.
That's
you
right.
You see
that's
it.
Right.
Just
across in those
the
river. Days.
It's like living in Encino,
Now, you're doing a podcast, and you've been doing a podcast with your daughter.
Since how many years?
Since 2016, so we're in our eighth year.
Tell us about it and where people can find it and what you're doing.
We started doing it in 2016. It drops a new episode, as they say, every Friday, and then we keep them all on online, so you can listen to our entire inventory. It's a one-hour interview.
And they're wonderful. And your daughter's name is Jessie, and she's really, really...
She's incredible. I mean, she didn't go
very well. She's my co-host and carries fully 50-70% of the burden of doing this.
Did she kind of suggest that you guys do a podcast, or were you doing it? And she said, how did she get involved?
I heard about this podcast medium and that things were happening there.
What is it?
How do I get into it and all that? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, the man who was the king of the medium 8 years ago and is still right up there was Mark Maron.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
He sort of blazed a trail.
Mm-hmm.
Jesse was working at the Independent Spirit Awards, the Film Independent Spirit Awards, which are held just before the Oscars.
She's a talent wrangler.
And I said to her, Mark Maron is here. I want to be on his podcast. See if you can get his contact info. And she did. And I followed up, and Mark followed up, and I had a very pleasant hour with him on his show. And that was heard by a fellow who was running a podcast network at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was working with Paul Scheer.
Yeah, that
Paul's a comedian and actor. Uh-huh. And Paul was curating shows for them. And he said, what would you think about working with a comedian discussing movies? I said, I think that sounds like a snappy idea.
Uh-huh.
And he paired me up with a guy I like very much named Baron Vaughn. Baron played Lily Tomlin's
son
on Grace and Frankie.
Oh, okay.
Had a good run on that show.
Sweet guy, sweet man.
Very nice guy, a real diehard film buff, too. So we were doing a show together.
I see.
And then Baron started getting more work, paying work.
The curse of celebrity
That's
success.
Right. And so Jesse filled in.
What's the name of the podcast?
Malton on Movies. It's available widely wherever one obtains podcasts.
And I did one of your shows
at
a wonderful location that you were at for a long time.
Meltdown Comics on
Meltdown
Sunset.
Meltdown Comics on Sunset. Was that fun?
That was fun indeed.
Yeah.
Well, can you believe it? We're out of an hour already.
See, let's not wait another, 6 years or three years
Leonard Maltin,
before we have
Alice
you guys
Maltin.
Back.
We'll get more things to say, okay?
What a pleasure to meet you.
We'll accumulate.
And ladies and gentlemen, the next time that you hear our show, we will be in a new location.
Fabulous downtown Glendale.
That's right, and we'll tell you all about
this.
This
is a moment here, Phil.
This is
because this is the end of an era.
This
is the last live show coming out of the KPFK hallowed
famous
hellhole.
Hellhole Studios.
Yeah, Hellhole Studios.
Yeah, and we apparently won't be back here for like 2 years because they're going to refurbish everything.
You can hear all of our shows on our website, sexyboomershow.com, and even Leonard's initial interview with us was really fascinating. I listened to it again. And
holds up very well, Leonard.
So
just like you.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us today.
Oh, yeah. This was fun.
This has been kind of a dream to have you both on this show.
Thank you.
And the book, once again, is Starstruck, My Unlikely Road to Hollywood. And you heard a little bit about that wonderful road that he has been taking and is still on.
And quickly, if someone had one movie to go to right now, what would you steer them?
Oh, gosh.
Leftovers.
Holdovers.
Oh, The Holdovers.
Oh, The Holdovers.
If you haven't yet seen Alexander Payne's The Holdovers.
Thank you both so much. It's lovely, lovely to be with you, as always.
Thank you very much.
Phil? I'll see you next week.
We'll be in two places at once when we're not anywhere at all.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, my friends.
Phil and Ted, Sexy Boomer Show. We'll see you next week.